The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the view of Wolfpack Research or any of its officers. The views and opinions expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on this program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. We are not investment advisors. We hold no registrations with the SEC, FINRA, or any other regulatory agency, and none of the opinions expressed on this podcast should be considered investment advice. Listeners should assume that we have positions in and stand to benefit from any stock or other security mentioned on this podcast. Do your own research before making investment decisions.
Welcome to the Wolf Den, everybody. This is Dan David. Joining us again is Carl, our sound engineer. God help us all. Ethan is with us as well. And today we have a very special episode. I know I say that every time, but gosh, I've been waiting for this one for a long time. We've worked very hard to get a COVID episode on here, a science-based COVID episode that we're going to talk about the vaccines. We're going to talk about the differences with vaccines. And we have two experts with us here today. We have Dr. Jessica Steyer and Dr. Andrea Love, co-hosts of the Unbiased Science Podcast. I suggest you listen to this podcast. It's a great one. I enjoy it very much. They cover a range of topics from immunotees to organic foods and pesticides through the myths on vaccines and COVID-19. Though I suggest you skip the one on pesticides, organic pesticides. Not that it wasn't a great podcast, it was, but I want all my money back for buying organic pesticides. I am extremely pissed off that organic pesticides are not as well tested as actually inorganic pesticides or regulated. So if you want to hear more about that, join their podcast. And they will make you feel terrible about yourself in that way. Dr. Steyer is the co-founder and CEO of Vital Statistics Consulting. Vital Statistics Consulting, among other things, COVID-19 services help businesses and other organizations integrate and analyze client workflow for physical workspaces, evolving epidemiologic research and public health policy guidelines to generate a plan for safe reintroduction of employees to your workplace. My God, thank you, Dr. Steyer. I mean, if anybody's doing God's work, you are right now. That is wonderful. Dr. Steyer holds a certificate in patient safety from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. I, of course, went there. Everybody knows that. She is a member of the American College of Healthcare Executives. Dr. Steyer, incidentally, also part of Animal Love Dog Rescue, which is awesome.
Yes, yes.
And cats, too, if you're into that thing, whatever.
My preference is dogs, but I love them all.
Cool. And Dr. Andrea C. Love, PhD immunologist, microbiologist, biotechnology, application scientist, public health and consulting. Is there anything you don't do, Dr. Love?
I have to wear many hats, I will say.
Dr. Love works at Nexcellium Bioscience, a company that uses Cellometer and Cellica and Cellogeo instruments for the cell quantification analysis and cell-based assays. You wanna repeat that for me? So
sure, yeah. So my full-time job is with a company called Nexcellium Bioscience, and we basically create, manufacture, and implement technology for biomedical research across a broad array of different research areas, including vaccine research, immunology research, cancer research, et cetera.
Right.
He's a real dummy.
Yeah, right. It's basically one of my hobbies, too, what I do in my pastime. And speaking of your hobbies, Dr. Love is an avid runner, and of the Unbiased Science Podcast, I think Dr. Love is probably the one biased one that might kick your head off if you don't believe in science. She's an avid runner, a tutor, Special Olympics volunteer, which is very cool, and wait for it, a national judo coach with the U.S. Judo Association. So do not screw with Dr. Love. All right. So tell us, we have a pandemic. We have what's called COVID-19, variants, call them COVID-20, 21, whatever, or just variants, UK strain. I have no idea why the UK isn't bitching about them calling it the UK strain, but whatever, South American strain, all of these things. Can Dr. Love, maybe starting with you, because It's on that part of it, and we'll talk to Dr. Steyer about how we reintegrate back to work and that kind of thing. Can you talk to us about the science of basically vaccines? Maybe we go into the history. What vaccines were, what this mRNA is now that's different from what the vaccines were, what that means to us, and take the scariness out of it for me, please. Maybe not for anybody else, but take the scariness out of it for me.
All right, sure. I'll see what I can do. So we can take a little trip down memory lane. So the very first vaccine or vaccination that we can probably attribute to, it would be Edward Jenner and the famous smallpox vaccination. So this was in 1796. And this was probably the first instance of rudimentary vaccination. And what happened was he had observed that obviously smallpox was ravaging, you know, the world. There was no cure, really no treatment. There were alternative methods to try and immunize people or make people immune to it, but they had a lot of risks associated with them. So he noticed that milkmaids were not contracting smallpox like the vast majority of the population, or they were contracting in lower numbers. And there's a related virus, and at the time they didn't know for what this virus was, but they called it cowpox. And basically, these milkmaids who were milking cows, they would develop these pustules on their hands and these lesions, and this they called it cowpox. And so he theorized that this cowpox was somehow related to smallpox. And so what he did, and it's kind of gross, so, you know, brace yourselves, but he took the pus.
It's already kind of gross, but go ahead.
He took the pus from some of these lesions on the hands of these milkmaids, and he mixed that into an open wound of an 8-year-old boy. He had a cut on his arm.
And any volunteers? And
human subjects research at its best. Yeah. But ultimately what happened was, you know, this boy developed mild cowpox, and then Edward Jenner exposed him to smallpox. So smallpox is called the variola virus, variola major, variola minor. Cowpox is called the vaccinia virus. So he exposed this boy to the variola virus, smallpox, and he did not contract smallpox. And he did this repeatedly. And so this was the first instance of what we consider to be vaccination, basically exposing an individual to, you know, an alternate form of a pathogen. And in this instance, it was very effective because the vaccinia virus is so closely related that by being exposed to that much more mild virus that causes cowpox, they actually established immunity to the very deadly smallpox.
So the first vaccine has its roots in child abuse. The worst, most negligent kind of child abuse.
There were not human subjects protections back then, I will say.
No. I think I knew the doctor's name. I had no idea the story behind that, where you find an 8-year-old boy, where you're just like, hey, you want to make 10 cents? I mean, like, I don't, wow. And then that worked. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So that's actually where the word vaccination comes from, the vaccinia virus, which is that first instance of a vaccine. Now, over the years, the thought was in order to establish vaccination or a vaccine-induced immunity, people had to be exposed to a live version of a pathogen in question. So, you know, we developed vaccines for, rabies and other things like that. In the early 1900s, we had a slew of new vaccines being developed. And ultimately, it was determined that you didn't have to just use a live virus. So throughout history, we've now developed vaccines using a variety of different technologies. The four that are kind of our traditional vaccines are these weakened viruses. So these are technically living viruses, but they're not as dangerous as the actual disease-causing pathogen. We have what we call inactivated viruses. So these are ones that are rendered completely inert. They can't actually replicate, reproduce, cause illness. And then we have these ones called subunit or protein vaccines. And then we have ones called toxoid vaccines. So those are kind of the four classes of vaccines up really up until the COVID-19 pandemic.
Inactive sounds the best. I mean, just like from a layman's term, I think inactive sounds the best. Is that the one that's grown in like a chicken egg or something?
Right. So the flu vaccine is an example of an inactive viral vaccine, and influenza virus grows really well in chicken eggs. We call it in ovo, and it just happens to really like chicken eggs. It grows well in them. Now, we know people have chicken egg allergies, so there are egg-free versions now, now that technology has evolved. But ultimately, the goal of all these vaccines is to mimic the pathogen, so that's the disease-causing germ, to a degree that it tricks your immune system into thinking you're actually infected, and then the immune system mounts this response to that disease-causing element. And so when you encounter it in real life, you don't develop illness because you already have memory immunity and you fight it off without getting sick. So that's really the broad goal of vaccines. And over the years, technology has evolved. So, you know, that's really what brings us to these new vaccine technologies. So the COVID-19 vaccines, the two that are authorized in the US, are using a technology called mRNA. There are other vaccines that are in development elsewhere, other vaccines that have been authorized elsewhere that use different technologies. But the mRNA technology basically builds off of some of these previous principles. So mRNA is a template for protein. So I mentioned that of those four types of vaccines we have ones that are called subunit or protein vaccines. Mm-hmm. And what those basically use is a little piece of the pathogen. And this is usually a protein. It can be a sugar in the case of certain bacteria. But what it does is it's a big enough piece to trick the immune system, but it's not the intact virus or bacterium. And it's usually a protein that's expressed on the outside of the virus. And that protein is called an antigen. And the antigen is the component that triggers that recognition by the immune system. So we have other protein vaccines that exist. So some examples would be hepatitis B vaccine, the HPV, so the human papillomavirus vaccine, and actually the pertussis component in the DTaP or Tdap vaccines is based on subunit technology. And what those use is just the isolated protein of the pathogen to trigger that immune response. So the mRNA technology kind of takes it a step further removed. And what it does is it uses just a sequence of RNA. So RNA is a template for our cells to make a protein. And that template ultimately tells this complex in the cell called the ribosome complex to read that sequence of molecules and synthesize a protein out of that. So what we're doing with these RNA vaccines is we're just giving them the code and we're saying, okay, we're delivering this code to our cells. The code is for the spike protein of SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19. And so that template, that code tells our cells, hey, make a bunch of this protein. And once they make that protein, the immune system recognizes it and mounts a response. So instead of simply injecting the protein, we're just injecting the code for the protein.
This is the spike protein that they talk about.
Correct. Yeah? Correct. The spike protein. The virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is the virus that causes COVID, has these spikes mm-hmm. all around the outside of the viral particle. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a crown. That's why it's called coronavirus. Yep. So the spike proteins are the piece of the virus that interact with our cells and allows the virus to infect us. And it's also the first piece of the virus that our immune system is recognizing as this foreign invader.
Right. It's the first thing that touches our cells, right? That's what adheres to our cells is that spike protein.
Exactly.
What I'm not understanding, well, we can see each other. And I think the audience knows that that's how I do this, but I don't release the video. You're showing me your little crown with your spike protein, and we've all seen it before, right? It's got, it looks like it's got a bunch of little horns coming off of it that crown at the top and kind of like little suckers that adhere to you. It's pretty scary, really. So what I don't understand, so we have RNA in us already, right? Correct? So there's DNA and there's RNA already within each human being. Is that true?
Yeah. So it's a great place to kind of set the stage. So DNA in organisms like humans is this genetic encyclopedia, right? Yeah. So it's the code for everything that makes us what we are. And the DNA lives inside a particular compartment of our cells called the nucleus. Mm-hmm. And the DNA stays in there forever, doesn't leave. Periodically, that DNA or pieces of that DNA are converted through a process called transcription into RNA. So you can imagine DNA being a multi-volume encyclopedia for everything that makes us who we are. And RNA would be like a page of notes you hand wrote from a particular volume of that encyclopedia. So it's a similar but not identical version, and it's not comprehensive. It's just a little piece. Mm-hmm. So every RNA that our body is synthesizing, that ultimately is turned into a protein. And so humans, we have all sorts of proteins, right? We have proteins in our hair, in our nails, in our cells, everywhere in our body, right? Everything that makes us what we are synthesized through this process. So we already have the machinery in order to produce that protein. So when we inject a piece of RNA, our body's going to be like, oh, hey, some RNA, I'm going to turn it into a protein, because that's what our cells do ultimately. But the RNA stays within a discrete compartment of our cells. It doesn't go into the nucleus and it doesn't interact with that DNA.
So the nucleus being the DNA, and this kind of addresses the falsehoods that are put out there that, you know, you're either going to change your own DNA or you're going to have children with three legs or some ridiculousness like that. Since the messenger RNA and the RNA itself doesn't actually get through the nucleus, any of our DNA, it cannot change our DNA.
Correct. Absolutely. And it's also important to know that the RNA only lasts, it only exists for a very short period of time. So once it's injected into your body through the vaccine, your cells are going to make protein from reading that template, and then the RNA is going to degrade very quickly. The turnover of RNA is usually 24 hours, 48 hours. So it's not going to hang out. It's not going to get into other cells. It's not going to circulate throughout your body beyond that short period of time that it's needed to make those proteins. And that's really the challenge with why these vaccines need to be stored at such a cold temperature, because RNA is very unstable. Mm-hmm. In the lab, we have to store it in those giant minus 80 Fahrenheit freezers that, you know, everybody's freaking out about now, because if you don't, it will degrade and it's no longer useful.
That's for Pfizer's vaccine, but not Moderna's.
Yes. So Moderna, it's also using RNA, but it uses a different formulation. So they're able to stabilize the RNA through these fats, these lipids that basically make this little bubble, protective bubble around the RNA. So the formulation of Moderna's fats enable it to be more temperature stable. It still has to be stored in a freezer. It's not refrigerator stable, right? Beyond a short period of time. But those fats enable the RNA to be a little bit more sturdy than in the Pfizer vaccine.
Right. And are there any other differences between these two vaccines? I know that Pfizer's is a much lower dose and seems to be, what I've read, have a few less symptoms as far as, you know, the achiness, the sore spot on your arm, or maybe your lymph nodes swelling up for a day or so. I think they both have that, which I guess medical professionals are saying, see, it's working. You're supposed to have some kind of reaction, right? Or generally.
Yeah. So, you know, yes, the Pfizer kind of total dose of RNA is a little bit lower than the Moderna. They both use a series of solutions called buffers, which stabilize the pH. The specific buffers in Pfizer is using a buffer called PBS, and the buffer in Moderna's is using a buffer called tris acetate. They're slightly different. They have the same end goal. The lipids are really the lipid formulations are really the major difference. They both use cholesterol and a PEG moiety, but they each have their own proprietary other lipids. And that's really the dosage and the lipid formulation is really the major difference.
So the major difference is the dosage and the fat shit they have around
the fat.
It.
Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of the major difference in all of us.
Yeah.
So there you go. Interesting. So mRNA, I talked to you briefly just a second a few weeks ago, and I had said that one of the concerns that had been brought up to me in the past is that messenger RNA technology had not been used in any vaccines prior to COVID-19. And thankfully, you told me that was not true. Maybe on a wide scale, but you can take it from there, maybe?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, RNA technology has been in development for decades. And over the course of, you know, starting in the 1990s, RNA was actually being used to work on developing new vaccines. So we know that we don't have a vaccine for everything, right? We don't have vaccines for a lot of diseases that routinely plague humans. We have some treatments, we have some preventatives, but you know, the goal is to find more versatile vaccine technologies that can be used for a broad array of diseases that are emerging or, you know, are plaguing the world all the time. So, you know, over the years, starting in the 1990s, RNA-based vaccines have been used in the course of infectious disease research. So vaccine candidates have been made for things like Zika, influenza, rabies, Ebola. There was even a pilot one for HIV, respiratory syncytial virus, the papillomavirus, is a really broad array.
SARS?
I don't know if the SARS candidate was an RNA-based one. I don't believe it was.
Seems like this would be the most similar, right?
For sure. The SARS epidemic or pandemic was kind of its own little self-limiting epidemic. And yeah, the problem was by the time they had a vaccine available for testing, the pandemic had essentially self-limited. And so if you don't have the disease present to test for clinical trials, you can't really test a vaccine candidate. But, you know, we had done a bunch of groundwork for identifying that spike protein and understanding how it caused disease. But these RNA vaccines, they didn't progress, not because they were dangerous or anything like that. It was simply, they were just not that effective. And ultimately that is the challenge with that RNA molecule. It's very unstable. It needs to last long enough in a vaccine to be turned into that protein and for the immune system to recognize it. And so a lot of the decades of research, we're trying to figure out what the best delivery method were, those lipids that we talk about, how to stabilize the RNA, how to modify the RNA so that it could be transported appropriately. So all of these things were really decades of research to kind of bring us to this point. And there were several clinical trials. There was an example of a human rabies vaccine that was based on RNA that was completed phase one clinical trial in 2018. And so it wasn't that this is brand new. It's just all of the years of perfecting the technology kind of led us to where we were, so that when this pandemic erupted, we could utilize all of those, you know, pieces of data to make a very effective vaccine for COVID-19.
Wow. It hurts to say this, but it almost like this has happened at the right time. I mean, it's weird. It really is kind of weird. Like, if this would have happened 10 or 15 years ago, we would be looking at a much higher fatality rate for a much longer period of time, I think.
It's possible. Yeah. I mean, we do have other vaccines in the pipeline. We do have some vector-based vaccines. We have some protein subunit vaccines.
That's AstraZeneca?
Yeah. So AstraZeneca is a vector-based vaccine. Novavax is starting phase three with a protein-based vaccine. There's two Chinese vaccines and an Indian vaccine that are an inactive vaccine. So we have other prongs in the approach, but RNA is really fast to make. So that's really why they're kind of leading the chase, because it's a lot easier to make some RNA than to grow a lot of virus. To make an RNA vaccine, you don't even need the virus in the lab. You just need that sequence.
Right. So talk to me about the epidemiology of this. I mean, like, if this was Ebola or something that was just much more deadly, with how this can be dormant in you for a week or two, how deadly would it have been?
You know, it's interesting. So, you know, when we talk about kind of disease burden, or kind of the public health impact of a disease, there's incubation period and transmission and also disease severity. And so, you know, there's a lot of factors to consider. So Ebola is very deadly, right? It has up to 40% mortality rate, but it's relatively hard to transmit, meaning its reproductive value. You have to come into direct contact with blood or bodily fluids. And even then you need a pretty high dose of the virus in order to get sick. So, you know, with this virus, you have relatively low mortality rate compared to obviously Ebola, but it's very highly transmissible. Mm-hmm. It's more contagious than the flu. And because it has that really long incubation period where you feel perfectly fine, but are walking around potentially infecting people, that's really where the ability for it to spread so rampantly comes into play. And that's really distinct from the OG SARS, so SARS-CoV in 2002.
The OG SARS. I love it. I love it. The OG drop. Go.
So SARS was also very contagious, but you didn't have this asymptomatic transmission. And when people got sick with SARS, they were almost always hospitalized. So people weren't walking around kind of feeling crappy, mildly ill, and infecting other people. They're isolated. They're in a hospital. And so that pandemic burned itself out because there weren't more opportunities for community spread. And so a virus wants a balance of ease of transmission and causing enough disease so that it can spread itself and reproduce, but you don't want to kill your host too quickly or, you know, too many of them, because then of course they won't have a new host to live in. So it's this balancing act where something like COVID is hugely impactful because it has relatively high infectivity. It causes severe disease and it does cause death, but it also has this long period of time where it can spread undetected. And I think Jess is going to jump in here.
Before you jump in, I just want to say, like, you know, it's interesting that she just described this virus as if it's an intelligent life form.
Yeah, like a serial killer, like keep you alive for a little while. And
that's the microbiologist in me.
Well, I don't know that's wrong. Evolution.
No, it's, I mean, you know, they don't have a brain, right? They don't have a neural network, but it's evolution, right? That's, they're trying to reproduce and find a host, and that's their evolutionary goal.
Yeah, I'm not sure we have a brain at times. I mean, especially the way we've handled this. So, Dr. Steyer, maybe you can jump in and tell us, but it looks like we are setting ourselves up for the perfect storm here. We've had the long incubation period with something that spreads more rapidly, and then we've had this short incubation period where it burns itself out like Ebola, that's much more deadly. We combine those two and we don't have a public health policy. What's going to happen, Dr. Steyer?
Oh, gosh. Well, unfortunately, as we've seen over the past year, we were not able to successfully implement mitigation strategies as other countries have been able to do. So we really have backed ourselves into a corner where we really are reliant on these vaccines. It's our safe path out of this really dark chapter. But what I was going to add to what Andrea was saying, you know, we always like to point out that another distinction between COVID and other diseases, you know, people always compare it to influenza, is that mortality is not the only outcome. And that's something that's really frustrating. With COVID, we've seen that there are so many other long-term disabling effects. They impact every organ system. You have people with long-term, you know, there are mental implications. You have lots of, you know, blood clotting issues, cardiac issues. Agreed. long-term breathing problems. So it's frustrating for us when people are saying, oh, but you know, the mortality rate is actually not that high. Okay, but think about, first of all, don't get me started on that. You know, it's not necessarily true, especially when we look at certain subpopulations, but there are other outcomes. This is not just a binary liver doc.
It's high if one of your relatives dies.
Well, exactly. Right. Until, of course, it impacts you.
No, I will tell you, to your point, I have a friend that I went to school with, and she's 50, and she got COVID. No symptoms. She's asymptomatic. She's great, fine, whatever. 3 months later, she had a stroke. And they say that was COVID-related. Mm-hmm. And that's not even talked about. That this healthy woman had a stroke 3 months after being asymptomatic of COVID, and you just think you won the lottery because you got COVID in and you didn't get sick, but you know, it can come around to really get you.
Absolutely. My husband's an ER doctor, and so you know, he just I'm a researcher, so I don't like anecdotes, but he does come home with these crazy stories, you know, young, seemingly healthy, otherwise healthy people. He had a woman who was pregnant and she died from COVID. And it's, you know, it was a similar vascular issue. It was blood clotting, ended up being pulmonary embolism, because you combine the fact that I guess pregnant women are more likely to have blood clotting issues. So you combine that with COVID and it was, you know, a recipe for disaster.
Well, it's got to be a fun dinner table at your house over the last year.
Oh, gosh. Yes. Well, it's a nice break from the, you know, x-rays of people shoving things up their orifices. You didn't see that coming, right?
Well, I mean, listen, nothing surprises me anymore. And I totally get the mental breakdown of this, like, you know, the increase in alcoholism and drug abuse and, you know, just the fatigue of not being out. I mean, for Pete's sake. I mean, my circle in life has gotten so small. Every time I see Carl, I just want to punch him. Like, I mean, it's like day I see this guy, and for no reason. I think everybody's kind of going through that, and it's got to have an effect on your physical health at a certain point, your mental health that way.
Mental health, emotional health, you're dealing with the anxiety of, you know, wanting to prevent yourself and your loved ones from getting the disease.
Right.
And then the implications of isolation. Yeah. And, you know, I have two kids. I'm freaking out about keeping them home from school. And what does that mean, developmentally for them?
Now, wait a minute. Everybody will tell you, kids are fine. Who cares? If they get it, they're 100% safe. No kids die. I mean, tell us about it. What's going on there?
That's not true.
Exactly.
Of course, we know that's not true. It does, you know, there are data that do suggest that adults do transmit the disease more easily to each other and to children versus children infecting and transmitting to adults. But that does not mean that it doesn't happen.
Right.
Uh-oh, Andrea's got something. You can talk about the variant or no?
Well, I was going to say, depending on age groups. So very young children seem to be less efficient at transmitting the virus, but older children through teenagers actually can transmit it as efficiently as adults, even though they don't present with as severe primary illness. So again, they could be these community spreaders, right?
Super spreaders, right.
Right. And they could be making teachers sick, aides sick. They're bringing it home. They're passing it along to their parents or their grandparents. And there actually have been some data that children who recover or test positive for COVID-19 have biomarkers for acute inflammation and cardiovascular implications. So it's, you know, we don't know those long-term effects, right? We don't know if something developmentally is going to occur later in life as a result of you know, surviving COVID-19.
Yeah, I guess we're going to find that out later in life, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So where does that leave us? What about these variants?
The variants.
Yeah. Andrea, this is...
Sure, quickly. So there are, obviously, viruses mutate. We just talked about evolution,
so
right?
Fast. They're so fast, they're mutating.
They're always trying to outwit us, right? It's this evolutionary arms race between human and pathogen. Now, relatively speaking, these viruses mutate relatively slowly compared to other viruses like influenza or like HIV. But, you know, we hear about it in the news, so it seems like it's very fast.
This one actually is kind of fast, don't you think, Dr. Love? This is kind of fast.
compared to other viruses, other RNA viruses, it's relatively slow.
Okay.
Now, things that accelerate it are rates of transmission. So the more spread you have of the virus, the faster it will mutate, because every time it's transferred from one person to another, it's an opportunity to mutate.
Yeah.
And these mutations are random, of course, but things that are advantageous for them, like the ability to infect us more easily, these increased transmissible variants, those are going to persist evolutionarily. They're going to be selected for. And so these variants seem to have changes in that spike protein. Right. And these changes seem to improve the ability of the virus to infect us. And we don't yet know if it means you can get infected with a lower dose, or they're better able to grab on. And so, you know, you're going to get infected with lower time exposure. We don't know the mechanism yet, but we know that these new variants are more contagious, essentially. So, you know, we originally were calling them UK, South Africa, Brazil. They have official names. So they're 501Y, V1, V2, and V3.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
that's nomenclature in virology for you. So basically they're classified where on that protein the mutation is. So that 501 position, that's amino acid 501. And so they have a substitution where one amino acid is changed for another, and that changes how the spike protein interacts with our cells. And so obviously the concern is, what does this mean if I've recovered from COVID? Does that mean I can be susceptible to these new variants? What does this mean for the vaccines? Does it mean they're no longer going to protect us? So everybody's racing to answer these questions. Right now, it appears that there is a little bit of an effect where we see a little bit of reduced ability of antibodies to neutralize those viruses, the variants, but it's not completely abolished. So the vaccines should still be protective. They were very, very protective. So we don't expect anything too dramatic. But it also means, because we're seeing these mutations crop up, that we need to prioritize getting people vaccinated. The faster we do it, the better. Right. The longer this kind of gets drawn out, the more opportunity for more mutations.
With the UK variant, because I'm just not playing that game. I'm not, you know, I'm gonna go with COVID-19 and not offend China, because I do that on a daily basis on other issues anyway. But with the UK variant, it seems like Moderna says that the efficacy is pretty good with what they have right now. Maybe not 94%, but pretty good. The spike protein is a little different. But with the African variant, it's 6 times less effective. That's the bad news. The good news is it would only take them 6 weeks to change that spike protein and get something new out there to address the African variant in a whole way. So, I mean, I think that's at least a good news, bad news scenario there.
Yeah, so the study, the South African study, that was actually looking at convalescent serum. It wasn't looking at vaccinated people. So what that is they were looking at antibodies from people that had recovered from actual infection, and they saw a reduction. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they would get infected again or that the vaccine wouldn't be protective. Moderna actually put out Moderna and NIH, where they looked at vaccinated people and protection against all of those variants that are circulating. They did see a little bit of a reduction, but it was not enough to negate the protective capacity of the vaccine. And so what they're doing here is they're looking at antibodies produced in response to vaccination, as opposed to antibodies produced in response to getting the actual illness. And that's important because in the clinical trials, the immune response to the vaccine actually is more potent than the immune response to natural infection. So yes, we might see a little bit of a reduction in efficacy, but we had such an efficacious vaccine begin with that it should still be protective. On the other hand, yes, we can reformulate if we need to. If they need to resynthesize RNA to address that new spike protein, they can do that quickly as well. So we've got a bunch of tools in the toolbox.
And Andrea, even if people are still, let's say they do get infected, it's going to lessen the severity of illness.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Just something else, some other good news.
Yeah. Well, which brings us to the point you had just made both of you actually, why it's so important to get vaccinated. You know, this is not on you as a listener, but I'm just going to say, we have screwed this up so bad over the last year and been so ill-prepared for no reason. I mean, literally, I really, truly, truly feel like I could have set up a national structure to vaccinate people better than our government has so far. And, you know, I pray for President Biden that he gets this done. He, at the very least, is talking about it every single day and focusing on it and hammering it home, almost to the, you know, exclusivity of anything else, which I'm fine with right now. But we have got to get it done. I can't believe we don't have centers set up right now where people are just lined up as they do in other countries. It's a disgrace. We ought to be calling our members of Congress every day saying, you suck. Get this fixed or you're fired. I don't care if you're a Democrat, a Republican, or a Martian. You suck. Get it fixed. Don't care about anything else right now. I'm a one-issue voter. We need to get this solved. So, any thoughts on that, doctors?
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's as simple as how wonderful it would have been to have had a leader to stand up and wear a mask and just tout the benefits of wearing a mask. The simplest, most cost-effective thing that we could have done to prevent rampant transmission. That alone would have been fantastic. But yeah, I mean, we're talking about, you know, we need a minimum of 70% of the population to be vaccinated to achieve herd immunity. And that number is going to go up as we have these mutations and variants.
Yeah, last I heard, that's 300 million people.
It's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people.
And there's so much distrust of, you know, of science and skepticism around the vaccines. We're really fighting an uphill battle here.
I mean, I think nationally we're averaging about 2.5 to 3% of the population's been vaccinated. And of course, there's huge variance state by state because there was not a national plan. There wasn't a national stockpile. As we've all found out now, there was nothing in hand.
No, you know, we told Pfizer in the middle of the summer we didn't need an extra 100 million doses. Like, you know, whatever.
But I think, you know, we need mass vaccination sites. We need all hands on deck vaccinating, you know, people. You know, it should be drive-through like we did for testing, right? You pull in, get your shot, pull over, wait 15 minutes, make sure you don't have an adverse reaction, go on your way. You know, I think the Defense Production Act activation is going to help substantially. We're going to be able to manufacture, deploy, and administer more vaccines. I'm encouraged by the really aggressive goals to get 100 vaccinations administered in 100 days. I really hope that we can hit that benchmark. But of course, we also have to fight the misinformation, right? We have to make sure that people are willing to get vaccinated. So we have to spread credible information. We have to dispel rumors that seem to crop up as soon as the previous one is debunked.
Well, it's going to be extremely difficult. I mean, first, on your comment, I think I'm reading more and more, and the United States is always at its best when it's the private sector and the public sector working in harmony, because quite frankly, our private sector is much more efficient. And when you hear things like Google is putting in $150 million for just the purposes of education, cool. And Amazon is helping with distribution. That's great. We're not just going to rely on UPS and FedEx and whatever else. We're all hands on deck. But when it comes to the misinformation, I mean, look, listen, I've talked to some of my minority friends over the last month and about the vaccine. And, you know, from educated to non-educated like myself, there's a real hesitance there. And I'm saying, look, man, you know, the science is there. You have to do this. I'm going to do this. You have to tell your parents to do this who are saying they're absolutely not going to. And you know what he says to me? He's like, listen, if you wanted this to be a simple decision for me and my parents, you shouldn't have poisoned our people for the last 300 or 400 years, you know, with these vaccines. And that's what we're dealing with. Like, it's a hard thing to overcome when we've used a minority community as guinea pigs, as that boy with Dr. Jennings, right? I mean, that's what we've done in this country. And it's going to be a really tough push. But I think, you know, we're all going to have to hold hands and try and get it done together and show that, you know, we're first in line and we're going to do it. And hopefully it gets there, because it's got to be the majority and minority community getting it done.
Yeah. And, you know, the issues within, you know, persons of color community are obviously well-founded. The Tuskegee, you know, experiments were horrific. Yeah. You know, I think there is some misinformation circulating around that specifically, though. First of all, this was with regard to men who had contracted syphilis, and they were being told that they were being treated for it, and they were not. It actually had nothing to do with the vaccine, but they were not, provided the...
I know that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and I've explained that.
Right, right.
But they think that, I mean, you know, and rightly so, the Tuskegee experiments were not the only ones.
Correct. Correct. Okay. There's a lot of history of racism in science and medicine.
Right.
Jess is going to, jump in and talk about human subjects protections.
Oh, well, yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, this is such a complex issue. And, you know, I'm a public health scientist, so it's, you know, I feel it, a real sense of responsibility. How can we communicate to these certain minority populations? You know, we've had conversations with faith-based leaders, church leaders and priests and preachers and, you know, really trying to break through to the community. It can't always be scientists and medical professionals giving this information, because there's just this inherent distrust. So we need to deliver the information differently and from different sources. So that's definitely something that we are working on. And to Andrea's point, my goodness, the human subjects protections that are in place for any clinical research, these things are studied to death, for lack of a better word, in clinical trials. Then you talk about having real world effectiveness data. Now that, you know, we've vaccinated millions and millions of people, we see the safety, we see the efficacy, we see the effectiveness. But you're right, Dan. I mean, we know these things. We could talk till we're blue in the face. It's how do we communicate this and convince these certain populations? It's very challenging.
Well, it begins and ends with education, which we've done a very poor job with in many communities. And by the way, good luck in the Islamic community, too. For some reason, they don't trust us. So I totally get that as well. So we've got big hurdles there. And I applaud Google for saying, look, there are a lot of people that can work on delivering things, that can work on administering this vaccine, but we're going to work on education and getting that message out. Nobody else had really said, we're going to work on messaging. And if it's one thing that Google is good at, it's messaging, you know, and getting us all to use their platform exclusive of anybody else's. That's a whole nother subject. But in this case, maybe it can be for the greater good. Who knows?
Right.
So,
I mean, I'm thrilled about that. You know, we've found this year that scientists are stepping up to kind of fill these voids, because we're not getting it from leadership. We're not getting it at a national level. And, you know, I mean, we have a very active presence on social media. We finally springboarded, you know, the pandemic into this podcast we've talked about doing for years, because there's such a dearth of reliable information. We felt this obligation to kind of fill that void. And there's many others like us out there, right, who are full-time scientists and are trying to help provide information to the general public, because there isn't, you know, stuff coming from the top.
You ladies are rock stars. I love the unbiased science podcast. I mean, you want to listen to that, or, you know, listen to LeBron James or one of these guys that get paid hundreds of millions of dollars to dunk a basketball. Nothing against them. It's great. But look, I learned something when I'm listening to you, and that's kind of a rock star thing. And it's important these days. I'm never going to dunk a basketball, but I might be able to educate somebody I love and, you know, in this case, save their lives. So that could be kind of important. I appreciate what you're doing. Are there, you know, any last thoughts that you have that could help our community, that could tell us where we need to go in the next week, month, 6 months?
Well, I would just say, I mean, we're focused so much on the vaccine now, and there's no question, unless you have legitimate medical reasons to not be vaccinated, you know, if you have a severe allergy to any of the specific vaccine ingredients, or if you have a severe reaction to the first dose, you should get this vaccine. There's no question about it. It's safe. We have the data to support it. There, you know, and we can debunk till we're blue in the face. We do this all the time. No, it does not alter your DNA. No, it does not cause infertility. No, you can't get the virus from the vaccine. There's no virus even present in the vaccine.
Yeah.
But it's more than just vaccination. I mean, I think I'm thrilled that there's an emphasis on that. And there's no question we all need to get the vaccine, but it's not a magic pill. It doesn't provide 100% protection, and it also doesn't provide protection immediately. So I hope we also focus on, I know it stinks, but continued mask wearing, continued social distancing. You know, there's also testing. Testing remains a really big piece of this puzzle. Mm-hmm. We have to keep getting the message out that, you know, the rapid test in particular, there really are some issues with those tests. They have very low sensitivity, which means there's a very high false negative rate.
Correct.
So, you know, taking a rapid test and having a negative result and then going to host a dinner party is not a good idea.
No.
Because we have an average false negative rate of over 50% on those rapid tests.
Right.
So, you know, we have to do our part too. It's amazing that science has stepped up and created this vaccine, but our part is not done. Unfortunately, we're going to have to suffer through this for a little bit longer. The very least we could do is wear masks and get ourselves Agreed. This vaccine.
Agreed. Well said.
And I would add, you know, this is going to get worse before it gets better. I really appreciate the new administration's frankness in this matter. You know, just because they have these plans in motion, again, nothing is instantaneous. The damage has been done, right? There's a time lag from when you get infected to when you develop illness, to when you get hospitalized, to when you die. So there's going to be several months from now where we're going to see all the fallout from holiday celebrations and family gatherings and ongoing community spread. And we need to have a certain number of people vaccinated before we actually start to see the impact of vaccination. Couple that with the more transmissible variants, which have the risk for faster spread. We have to be more stringent with mask wearing and those sorts of measures as well. So I think people need to be very realistic that, you know, this isn't going to turn around tomorrow. It's going to take time. And especially in the winter, where I know people are, you know, more apt to spend time indoors unmasked with other people. Once the weather gets nicer, you can spend more time outdoors. And that is lower risk, but not no risk. You know, the more people you have together, that's more risk. But yeah, certainly, you know, get your vaccine. Practice those mitigation measures. We actually posted a couple of days ago about double masking because of the more transmissible variants. That's something that you want to consider as well. And on top of that, you know, I think, you know, what you mentioned, Dan, about taking the information we provide and passing it along to your loved ones, that's so critical, right? We have to play this game of telephone right now because a lot of people, they don't want to listen to some stranger they've never met, you know, some scientist who's, you know, throwing their credentials around, even if it's accurate, right? There's an emotional component to making these decisions to get vaccinated, to wear your mask and things like that. So, you know, we have to marry the data with the emotional component, the psychology of this in order to get, you know, better uptake of the vaccine, to get better compliance with mask wearing and all of these sorts of things. And it really needs to be a community effort, right? This is an infectious disease. It doesn't, you know, it's not like if you don't believe in it, you can just, you know, stay in your little bubble. If you get infected, you're spreading it to other people, regardless of, you know, your interactions, your beliefs, whatever the case happens to be. These decisions that a person make affect everybody when you're talking about transmissible disease.
No, it will affect everybody and has.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah,
you know, last week, 2 weeks ago, we were crossing this huge threshold of 400,000 deaths. God rest their souls. We're at like 425 now. 500,000, a half a million is a foregone conclusion.
Absolutely.
We'll be lucky. We will be lucky if it's all said and done. We don't get to a million before this is all said and done. So like we've said, it's not a big deal until it happens to you or somebody you love, I guess. To me, it is a big deal. I'm glad it is to you. I'm glad you both shared this with us. Please tell us your Twitter handle so we can follow you there too. That's important. What is that?
So our Twitter, Instagram, Facebook is at UnbiasedSciPod. We share daily posts in addition to our weekly podcast episodes, which you can find on our website or on the streaming platforms.
I think I'm already following you on Twitter. I think everybody else should too. Listen to the podcast. And hey, if you like our podcast, you may want to follow us on Twitter as well. If you like this show, you might want to retweet it and retweet the Unbiased Science Podcast show as well. Thanks for joining us. Get vaccinated, get educated, get real. Thank you very much. If you hear me howling.